All right, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Today, my guest is Max Zuckerman. He's a guitarist and singer-songwriter. And in 2020, he released his debut solo album, The Corner Office, which I only discovered recently, and I love it. It's very much a descendant of Gaucho and the Nightfly. You know, the album is made up of 6 songs, each of which is a perfectly arranged jazz pop epic featuring satirical lyrics about creeps and sleazebags. So, you know, it's very much in the spirit of Fagen and Becker. And it's also hugely influenced by 1980s Japanese city pop. We get into all of this in our discussion. And to be honest, you know, I've had this album in pretty steady rotation since the beginning of the year. And what surprised me was how little coverage of the album there has been. I mean, basically nothing from the usual music blogs, you know, nothing from Pitchfork or Stereo Gum. Basically no social media. You know, I kind of had to track Max down. So it's kind of a hidden gem. And if anything, hopefully this episode will get more people to just listen to the album because it's great. So go track it down. It's streaming on all the platforms, including Spotify. Without further ado, this is my conversation with Max Zuckerman. Enjoy. Like, there was a thread about, like, you know, contemporary albums influenced by Steely Dan, and a bunch of people were sharing things. And I checked out some of them, and they were okay. You know, I'm kind of on the lookout for this stuff because then it's like someone I can have on the podcast, or just like I like that kind of music.
Yeah.
And I've had a few guests on here who definitely have like a Dan influence.
Word.
But like, I was doing this radio interview a few months ago with this, like, these two guys in college. And one of them just like mentioned your name.
What college? I'm actually kind of curious because it's weird. Like, this music sort of like, I don't know if it really, like, I don't even know where it's gotten out to. Because
that's
such
what I don't get. Like,
yeah, I don't like it's such a bizarre. I mean, I made it, like, I got some buddies. Like, I have like a main band I play with, like Blue Jazz TV, which is like, I mean, we've all had kids in the last like 3 years. So it's like,
congrats.
Thank you. But it's, you know, obviously that changes the landscape. But we were just doing our thing, and there's like, you know, I guess now I'm getting to like interview stuff, like, but like, you know, we were doing this collaboration stuff, and like, I was really obsessed. Obviously we're all obsessed with Steely Dan, but like, I was also really obsessed with like Japanese city pop. This is like, man, I want to say like 8 or 9 years ago. And I was sort of DJing it a little bit at just like bars and stuff in New York, because I was like, dude, this is like the sickest music ever. And I was like getting records shipped from Japan, and I was just going deep, deep down the rabbit hole, because there was like a level of production there that I was just like really into. And so that's when I was like, okay, I'm going to make my own thing. But like, it's definitely like, once I made it and I put it out, my thought was like, this is just going to be for friends, really. And then it's sort of just like, it was weird. Like, there's random fucking people who came out of the woodwork. I was just like, whoa. But, and then this like guy in Japan heard it, and he like, I mean, he put it out on vinyl, which I think was awesome. That was sort of changed. I was like, whoa, I guess people are listening to this kind of music. So, but, it is sort of, it opens up a whole, the internet's crazy like that, where you're just like, I have no idea who is going to listen, even hear this. So, I mean, like, what college were these guys at?
UCSB maybe.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I don't know. So I was doing this. I mean, one of the guys is on Twitter. He followed my account. He asked, he does this like interview series on YouTube where he interviews random music people on Twitter. And he asked if I would do a Steely Dan episode with him. And I did. And kind of like 3/4 of the way into the interview, he, you know, he's drops, we were talking about the Nightfly. And then he was like, yeah, there was this album by Max Zuckerman called The Corner Office that's very Nightfly, that came out like 2 years ago. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, I've never heard of it. But like I said, I'm always on the lookout for this kind of stuff. So I made a mental note. And then, I don't know, a couple months went by. And then I somehow remembered to check it out. And honestly, it was like fucking fantastic. Like, I was completely blown away by how good it was. Like, on every level, like the production, the musicianship, the arrangements, like the lyrics. I love the like lyrical approach. It's very city pop, which I love. It's very Steely Dan, very Donald Fagen. And then I like looked around and there's not much on it. And I was very surprised because it's such an accomplished piece of work. Like I couldn't find a single interview about it that you had done, like not one.
I've done none. That's correct.
And I'm just shocked because it's like I said, it sounds very like, it sounds very professional. And I just dig the album. Like I've listened to it like a bunch. Like it's great. So,
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I mean, it's yeah, I mean, I don't know. It is weird. But I mean, I feel like the response I got more was actually in Asia. I think probably because of the city pop thing. But like there was like definite, well, I mean, small potatoes, but there were like people who were like, holy crap, like we love this music. I'm like, well, yeah, because this is like I've just been listening to music from Japan for the last like 4 years. So I mean, I do think I was on a crest of a wave there, at least in Japan, that sort of it didn't, I mean, obviously this doesn't translate to any real life. I mean, I don't know what the, I mean, I'm a bit of a cynical person when it comes to like music landscape these days, but like I figure you just do it in your bedroom and just make it good. That's all that matters. If it's good and you like you listen to it and it gives you that feeling, that's all that really matters. So it's hard to do that though. You have to have a lot of time.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you put a lot of like time and energy into this project. Like from just like I said, the quality of it is pretty high. It's not just some guy like dicking around, making a little. I mean,
Yeah, I
it
mean
doesn't
it's
sound like a little bedroom pop album. Like it sounds like a fully fleshed out, like thought
yeah, I
through,
mean
it's impressive.
well, it's weird when you do stuff by yourself, it's a lot more work. I mean I it's actually a lot more, it's not as much fun because you end up like like there's something about a collaboration where you're giving up control over a lot of aspects of things that actually make your life easier. Because you don't own it completely, so you're looking at the finished product, thinking like, oh yeah, there's some of me in there, but it's not all me, and like the cumulative effort is like its own weird little monster, and you can sort of walk it, you watch it walk around, and you go like, oh that's cool, I wouldn't have expected that, but when it's only you, it's like really, it's like listening to yourself talk. It's just like. It can be really tedious at times. You're just like, God, I hate it. I hate that, And it's because it's like you're just like listening to yourself like dick around at home. And so a lot of it's about like subverting yourself in weird ways, which is basically just like constantly. It's like, I mean, if you saw the full session for some of these songs, like what it started out as and what it became, there's a lot of erasure and sort of like just like re-editing over and over again. Sections. I mean, some of these songs were actually two songs that got joined together. I think that's sort of what happens when you have like a solo project. It's just like a total Frankenstein, which is kind of fun, but it's also a nightmare. Especially when you get to mixing. But like, yeah.
So is this kind of your pet project, the corner office?
Yeah, I mean, I had it in the back of my head for a long time. I mean, obviously, I love Gaucho and the Nightfly. I mean, I don't know what I guess you would call it, sort of satirical lyrics, where it's like you tell a narrative that's sort of funny and dark. There's just not a lot of it in pop music. I mean, I feel like because it's hard to do it without it sounding like silly. And like the Nightfly, like borderline, it's like borderline silly, but it's so slick that it's like it's actually kind of it's like sleazy, which I think that's something that I've always really been attracted to, is like this sort of weird. It's like you can't quite get comfortable with it, and I think that that's important to, because that's sort of like, I don't know, a reflection of how I feel about life in general. It's like there's always like you can't get too comfortable. So, and then obviously just like the arrangements on a lot of these things are just so amazing. But I mean a lot of it's like, I'm not a jazz musician, so a lot of it's like a lot. It was a lot of work. I mean, I did go to music school, so I have a background in it, but it's like I didn't go to school for jazz, which I sometimes regret. That probably would have been more helpful. But in some ways, I feel like that's why Steely Dan, they're like kindred spirits, where it's like they sort of know how to play jazz, but it's like, why bother? There's people who can do it so much better, Like, just do something, like, make some weird music.
So obviously, you know, the corner office, there's a strong, I mean, it feels like you were trying to almost recreate the sound of those like 80s city pop albums. Was that like one of the kind of goals, or were you just trying to make an album and then it just turned out that way? And how did you do it? You know, how did you actually, because it does sound a lot like some of those records. So it's really impressive that you're able to get there.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that was the mixing process. I mean, well, it's interesting because it's like you sort of, I mean, it's funny, like you go through a lot of like, a lot of it's like weird A-B-ing. So, I mean, I have a ton of records that I listen to. And you, I mean, it's, I wouldn't say it's specifically city pop. It's more that general late 70s, early 80s vibe where, and there's a lot of specific things going on in the mix there that I really just, I fell in love with, you know? So, and it's like the clarity, the drum sound, you know, and like just like how those things were mixed. So once you sort of start reading about how those things were mixed and you start to realize that there's like a methodology to it. And so like, yeah, it was totally conscious. And a lot of it was, I mean, I had to throw out drum recordings that I made because the drums just didn't sound right. And a lot of that's like you learn, like, you know, like they're pretty dead drums. Like a lot of the drumming, like I did it at a friend's studio. He had just like a really small drum room. So I had a really, really dry dead room with like you know, and like we like taped up the snare and we just had them, you know, and there's like a lot of things you have to do to make sure you to like contain the drums, like the ringing of the drums, so you get this really tight sound. And then of course you like gate the fuck out of it and like compress it so that it's like really tight, and then you have to have a really good drummer. I mean, if Steve Gadd's out there, man.
Yeah. So you're going for like that dead drum sound that you hear on Asia with like some Gadd or even Murata.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like I'd say like I A-B'd a lot with I didn't A-B necessarily directly with Asia, but like I did, there's like some Japanese records that I say would be like equivalents. Like the First Light record by Makoto Matsushita has, I mean, I think that kind of blew up the internet, I feel like, for good reason, because of the production. I mean, the songs are amazing too, but the production is just, it's on another level. And the drum sound, especially on the B side, the first track on the B side, what's it called? I can't remember, but it's just like, it's so tight. And it's like, it literally has a kick part that lines up directly with the bass line. It's like, dump, bump, 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 ba-dum, bump, bump, bump. It's like rhythm like that while he's just got like a hi-hat going. And it was just, to me, that was, it just, it had this groove that was just so fucking sick. I was like, damn. And so I think in some of the stuff, I really tried to make the bass line up with the kick, but make it interesting, like bouncy, while there was like that steady sort of like snare going. So that was conscious. I mean, anything that I wanted to groove, I was sort of thinking that. I mean, the other big influence I had was Azimuth, the Brazilian jazz funk trio.
Love them. The drumming on those albums is fucking like, incredible.
Yeah, like Ivan Conti is like a fucking badass. I was also listening to like Bertrami, the keyboard player, his solo record Blue Wave. Just, I mean, that was more like towards the end of making it, because I made each song, like, you know, it's like it spanned like 4 years making it. So I started in one place, ended in another place. But like, I think the last song I made was The Guru, and that was definitely trying to be like more like Brazilian funk oriented. And and that was, I mean, I tried to do like slap bass that horribly. That was such a mess, but that was fun. I mean,
that song's awesome. I think that's my favorite song on the record.
Oh yeah. Oh cool. Yeah. So that was like that was definitely heavily influenced by Azimuth, just in terms of the vibe and the chords. I think I was thinking more in terms of like just classic 2-5-1s with lots of extensions. So just because that's sort of, that's like Roberto Bertrami's vibe. I mean, some of it, like his Perdido Alto number 2 off of his solo record. I mean, it's just a straight up, like a Perdido Alto is just like a classic, you know, Brazilian folk tune, but it's like, it's just like his chords are just so sick. Like it's, I don't know. They're like, I don't know. It's just the same way like Fagan has like certain moments where it's just like the harmony is just like so perfect. He's got that. Sometimes it like the stars align and you're just like, what the fuck? This is perfect. So I'd say like that was a lot of it was sitting at the Rhodes and just trying to come up with chords that sounded sort of remotely close to that. I feel like I in some ways is more pedestrian version, but it was like obviously, but it was like that was the inspiration there for sure. I mean, honestly, the production, a lot of that, I was confident that if I recorded drums well and I had the right idea in terms of parts, like things weren't stepping on each other. I mean, this is the luxury of working solo, is that you can come up with a part that perfectly fits in the places that you need it to. You know, like where you're not like in a band situation where you're like, you record something and then after the fact, you're like, oh, that kind of fights with that other thing, not realizing it while you're doing it. Like you can always go back and change it. So I went back and changed lots of things and sort of made it all fit together. And so then with the mixing, it's just about making everything super tight and dry, EQing everything so that everything had its own little pocket, and really cutting out the bass. I mean, that's sort of the funny thing is like, you think about what is the sound of a lot of these records. And I feel like in a way it's like, not letting the bass ring through anything and then controlling the mids like a Nazi, basically. So it's like the mids were like, I was like very, 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 yeah. And that was pretty much it. And then I think that is the vibe of all the records that I love from that era. I think it's really just doing that.
No, I think you captured it well. I mean, it sounds just like those records and I love a lot of that music. So it was, you kind of reverse engineered everything, like Steely Dan and the Nightfly, you know, influenced a lot of that Japanese city pop.
Yeah.
And then you took that sound and kind of brought it back by the kind of storytelling.
Right.
The lyrical approach really reminds me of like Gaucho and the Nightfly a lot. So it was like, right. You see what I mean, yeah, by like reverse engineering? It's like you brought city pop back to the West by adding songs about like these sort of, you know, rich sleazeballs and I don't know, douchebags. Yeah. Were you going for that? I hope I got it right.
Oh, definitely. Oh, most definitely. Yeah. Cool. No, I love writing songs about douchebags. That's my favorite.
Did you have like a concept in mind when you made the album? Like where you're like, I'm going to write like, you know, six songs and each one is going to be about, you know, this guy.
Oh, no. It wasn't necessarily specifically about rich douches, but then I mean, it's just, I think the song's just about douches, really. Yep. I mean, it's like there's every shape and form of douche out there. I was just like, you know, they're kind of fascinating because like what gets you to the place in life where you're just sort of a douche, and it's like, it's in some ways it's interesting, I think, but like,
I mean, they all reflect a certain kind of level of privilege, I think, at least.
Oh yeah,
if not
sure.
If not about, you know, necessarily like being wealthy. What's the guru about? It's about some sort of like spiritual.
I mean, I don't know if I'll ever get back to him, but when I was in high school, I guess he's a friend from middle school. He was like, he was sort of like a, I mean, he was a pretty good friend, but he kind of went on the weird, like, like guru tip. He sort of got into like psychedelics and stuff. I mean, I grew up in San Francisco and like, I didn't really hear from him for a bunch of years. And then a friend of mine was like, hey, dude, have you heard from what's his name? And I was like, no. And he's like, dude, check this out. And he showed me his Facebook page and he just become this like guru where he was just like teaching like life class, like it was sort of like life guidance class. And it's just like all these young girls and stuff that he was just, and he like had these things in Hawaii where people would be paying thousands of dollars to come and just like spend the week with him, where he would like help them visualize their better selves or something like that. And it was just like, so it's basically about him. You know, I was just thinking about like, cause I mean, he was already sort of like that in high school, but it was like not full blown. So a lot of these are drawn from directly from people I've at least like, it's what I've imagined their existence sort of looking like. But yeah, I mean, also California is like the land of, cults and gurus and such. I mean, more so Southern California, but you know, that's another character. They're, you know, ripe for the picking. So Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think the what are the other ones?
Well, the first song
Well,
is kind of about a guy who is with he's using an older woman like
yeah.
for her money.
So that one was actually that's not directly from anybody I know, but we have a Japanese friend who is staying with us, and I was sort of writing a song vaguely about it. Yeah, younger guy who's, gold digger. And he was like, oh yeah, that's there's a term for that in Japan. And so that's what it's called, Wakai Tsubame. It means like little sparrow. That's what they call those people. So
Okay.
I was like, perfect, dude. I got a chorus. So sometimes things just fall right in your lap. But I mean, and the corner office I think was more directly related to my disdain for unfettered capitalism. Sometimes I worry I'm gonna get like canceled, but then I'm like, yeah, you can't cancel me for this. This is all satire,
No, totally. I mean, it's very much in the Steely Dan way where it's like, yeah, these guys are cancelable, but you're making fun of them. So it's not like you're not endorsing their behavior. In fact, you're like, it's like a lampooning thing where like, Gaucho
Well,
is the same way. It's like the guy in Hey 19, or the guy in like Glamour Profession, like they're totally sleazy weirdo, you're capturing that same kind of thing.
Well, sometimes I worry that people don't necessarily get jokes anymore. I mean, or they don't know that you're doing that. But that's yeah. No, I mean, I hope it's clear.
Yeah, I mean, if they
But
thought, oh, this, well, I think so much of like pop songwriting now is like from a personal, point of view, where it's like, if Taylor Swift writes a song, the narrator of the song is supposed to be Taylor Swift. It's about her own, life and experience, worldview and point of view. I kind of miss the more kind of narrator style storytelling that I think a lot of music from, Steely Dan's era had. And I feel like your album kind of goes in that direction. I mean, I don't think any of
Oh
these,
yeah.
I never made the association that these songs were about you and your like
Oh
travels
yeah.
or your
Oh yeah.
experiences with women. It was clear to me that you were storytelling, right? These are stories about guys,
Oh
and
yeah.
a lot of them are pretty
Definitely.
deplorable, but
They're all deplorable. I don't think there's a single good one in there. But I mean, honest, like I feel like this is my problem. Yeah, this the like I don't know. It's weird. Like I feel like I end up listening to country music more than anything now. I mean, just because it's
really.
stories, it's like, well, I mean, it's funny because it's like it is weird. Like there isn't a big, like occasionally there's a song that's like an actual narrative about something happening, but a lot of times it's just like people talking about how I don't know. Like I don't know. It's a lot of it's like posturing where I'm like I don't know. Like can't you tell like a good story. I mean, I feel like that's what like all my favorite songs. I mean, my dad was like a Deadhead, so like I grew up with like that era of music. So a lot of it was like Bob Dylan and shit like that. And you just sort of and you realize that all of it's like most of it's stories. Like most of those songs are stories. And like that's what like draws you in. And it's sort of weird to think that like I don't know. Like I do hear a lot of, I mean, aside from the fact that pop songs don't even bother to change the chords for the chorus anymore, it's like they don't even tell a story. Like I'm just like, what are you talking about? You're just talking about your feelings. And I'm like, honestly, I get it. Like, I mean, music is for 13-year-olds. I mean, generally, like pop music. Like I think about the music I listened to when I was in middle school, and I go like, these guys were adults making this music. That's pretty ridiculous. I mean, that's sort of like the nature. That's I think this is why people come to Steely Dan later in life, is because like like a 13-year-old is not going to get anything out of Steely Dan unless I don't know. I don't think they are.
Yeah, it's kind of the grown-up version of all that music in a lot of ways.
Well, and it's but it's also like it comes with life experience that's like you have to have some cynicism, and like you don't want kids to have that kind of cynicism. So it's like the music you have to make for a 13-year-old can't be cynical. It can't have these things in it because it's like it's lost on them, hopefully. or if they're a cynical 13-year-old, then something's gone horribly wrong with their life. But like, I guess I feel like it's interesting because that is what pop music is. It's geared towards tweens, and it's like, and like, there's a certain point where there are people who, I mean, like, I don't know, like, I don't know. I live in Brooklyn, and like, you look at who's playing at like Forest Hill Stadium, and it's like, you know, it might be like 311 or something, and you go like, man, people still go to those concerts. Like, they still listen to the music that they found when they were literally 14 years old. And it's like,
They just want to relive the nostalgia or
yeah.
something. That's
Yeah.
all
Well,
it
it's
is
like,
for them.
I realize it's a very select group of people who keep searching for music all through their life. It's not like a guarantee. There's a lot of people, they find their thing and they run with it until they die. And like, I think as a musician, you have to accept that like your audience, you know, if you're trying to make anything at the age, I'm like 38. So it's like, if I'm making music at 38, that means anything to me, it's going to mean nothing to like tons of people. So it's like, I guess when I put this album out, like the expectation is like, yeah, well, I mean, my friends will have a laugh. I mean, I'll be really proud of it, and that'll be that, you know? And so, I mean, it's great that like people are getting out there and hearing it, because was a bit of a surprise. So, but it's cool. I mean, it's cool to know. I think this is where the internet's nice, because it does allow people, you know, who are searching, still searching for stuff, to find something, you know, because it's like, it's hard to find stuff. And I mean, especially stuff that like, when you start to have really specific taste, or like you're searching for something specific, it's hard to find things like that. It's not easy. Especially if you don't want to sit with the same music for the rest of your life, basically.
Yeah, I still like searching for new music or like new genres of music, whether it's new or not. But like even your album, it took me, a few years to discover, but hopefully more people will hear it now that you're on this podcast. That's kind of one
Well,
of the
yeah, I
goals, is
mean,
just to get more ears. 'Cause hey, if you like Steely Dan, you like,
yeah, I
city
mean,
pop, you like that kind of music, this is kind of right in that wheelhouse, right?
yeah, I mean, I'm a dad now, so it's like, I feel like that's what Steely Dan is. It's dad music, right? So it's like, I mean, hey, I'm making music for all the dads out there who are like, need a new album to chew on. But that's, I don't know. I mean, I guess, that's sort of what pop music is. So it's like, I was just thinking in the grand scheme, like when you were talking about Taylor Swift, I was like, yeah, I mean, there's no reason why she should be telling a narrative. I think this is why I love the 80s so much. It's like, I think there wasn't like, you know, focus groups to figure out what kids wanted. So they were just making all sorts of shit, you know, like they were just making all sorts of crap, like throwing spaghetti, seeing if it would stick against the wall. And I do think that that results in a lot more interesting music generally than like, you know, where you know who your audience is, you know what they like, and that kind of thing. I think not knowing actually makes for more, but it obviously probably makes a lot less money if you do it that way.
Yeah, I mean,
But I
everything's
mean,
based on algorithms now. So it's only based on data that you already had. You're just
yeah.
predicting things based on the past. There's no, I think it inhibits innovation, like that approach to creating art or distributing art.
Well, and there's a lot of layers to it. I mean, it's interesting. We can go into like
It
how
gets
the
really complex.
yeah the ec economics of like music now are like so effed up. It's like, I mean, it's just like, I mean, like, for example, I think I like when I put the record out, I put it out on my Dave, the sax player from Blue Jazz. I put it out on his tape label. And I think he put it up on YouTube, and there was like some people like who started commenting on the video, and he's like, dude, there's like people commenting on this in like Asia. And I was like, oh, cool. And we looked it up, and I looked at the comments, and they're like, oh man, I heard this in H&M. And the other person's like, oh yeah, I heard this in H&M too. And I was like, the fuck, my music's in H&M? And then I looked it up, and it's like, it was on Spotify, I guess. And it's like, as a corporation, you can make a playlist and pay Spotify just a flat fee, and you can take any music off of their platform and play it in your store on repeat for like a month. It's like a monthly membership, and then you don't have to pay royalties to the people who are on the playlist. Which was, I was like, I called up ASCAP. I was like, so am I gonna see any money from this? And he's like, no, you're not. But congratulations. I was like, oh, okay. But it's like one of those things where you realize like there's like they've subverted, because I mean ASCAP traditionally they had their nails in like TV and radio. So it's like if you get your music on TV or radio, you're gonna get some money. But it's like, yeah, like Spotify figured it out. They're just like, okay, we can subvert all of this basically. And so it is interesting. You realize like the only way to make money is playing live. You have to play live. And but that's also the reason why there isn't like this R&D in music anymore. Not to say the big labels were great, but it's like they had this money because they were selling records to just throw at bands to do shit. Of course, they're also telling bands you have to give them contracts. It's like you need to make 3 albums in a year, and that's not a great recipe for good music. But like, there were upsides to it too, where they were just like throwing money at some band and being like, hey, come in the studio, fuck around. And yeah, I mean, I think that it's sort of one of those things you look at the different angles of like where the music industry is now. And I think making a record in your bedroom is not a good way to pay the bills. But I mean, we have all this technology now where I can make a record that sounds passable as like some, hi-fi shit. But I mean, I think if you listen closely, you'd be like, maybe not. But it's passable. So, and I think
Passes to
that's,
me.
yeah. And that's something that you did not have even like 10 years ago. I feel like it would have been pretty hard.
And in the span of a few months, some, random person at an H&M in Hong Kong or something can hear the
Yeah.
song, right? I mean, that couldn't
Right.
happen
No.
necessarily.
Yeah. So I mean, in that sense, I was sort of, I mean, I think the weirder thing is not knowing who's even heard it. There's
Yeah.
not really, because there's no paper trail really. So it's like, you're just sort of like, oh, it's out there. And this is like somebody like you messages me. I'm like, wow, cool, awesome. You're like, I heard it from some guys at some college. I was like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, I love that. I love the kind of serendipitous discovery of music. Like that's my favorite. Like I whenever I like get a recommendation from a human, not an algorithm, I'm much more likely to actually try and like listen to it or engage with
Right.
it on a deeper level. So like the fact that I had like talked to this guy, we were messaging, we did this interview, like he has good music taste. He said, this sounds like the Nightfly. I really like this album. I was like, okay, like I'm gonna take that extra step to like, go on my computer, look it up, listen to it, see what the whole, see what it's about. And then I was like Googling about you and there was just so little, I couldn't believe it. Because there are albums that are doing a thing that's like not too dissimilar from you that don't do it like half as well, and there's like way more shit. They have like 500,000 Spotify listeners. So I was just honestly, I mean, I don't know. I'm surprised that it hasn't gotten more traction, and maybe it will at some point, but
Well, I mean, yeah, it'd be great. I mean, I don't know what that would necessarily translate to. I'm just happy that people like it. I mean, honestly, I don't really know how. I think you can break the internet if you know what you're doing, which I obviously don't. I think that's part of it. So, but like, there are people who they know how to get their shit out there. Also, I mean, like, I don't know. It's, you still gotta get lucky in some respects, and then, I don't know. Also, when you do a solo project, I mean, there's a big problem where I can't play this live. I mean, I'd have to like hire a bunch of like musicians. And that's a pretty big hurdle to get over if somebody's like, hey, you want, 'cause the people I know who do well, they go on tour, I mean, I have a kid now. I'm not doing that shit. So it's
Okay.
like, I mean, there's a level of like,
So a
I mean,
corner
it's a,
office tour, that's not ever
I mean, I don't know. I'd never say never. I think
gonna
there's
happen.
one of the, there's, I mean, obviously I'd love to do it live. That'd be awesome. But it's like,
It's never
it's
been performed live, these songs, ever?
never. I mean, because it's like, I would have to, I'd have to hire a whole band. And then, I mean, and realistically, I'm kind of a purist where it's like, and I would need to pay the whole band because I would not make them learn this shit without paying them, what I would think would be a fair rate, and so that'd be extremely expensive. So there'd have to be like a show that would at least pay for it,
That's
because
the
my,
exact reason that Steely Dan didn't tour with Asia. I don't know if you know this. Like,
oh no,
they made Asia, and then there was a whole plan to tour with it. Like, they booked venues, and then they needed so many great musicians to play that music. There was like Jeff Porcaro on drums, you know, Chuck Rainey on bass. Like it was all these legends.
Yeah.
And they like added it all up and they were like, we're going to just lose so much money doing this on tour. So let's just like go back in this. And the album was selling like crazy amounts, just like,
yeah,
it was during an era when, you know, people actually made money from just selling records. So they're like, let's just go back in the studio and, you know, we'll make another album. And
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw them do when they did the residency at Beacon Theater. I saw them do Gaucho, and
oh, awesome! How was that?
That was life changing. That was the best. That's probably the best live show I've ever fucking seen. I mean,
I'm really jealous because I actually haven't seen them do that one. I've been to two Beacon shows where they played an album, but not Gaucho. And Gaucho's my favorite album.
Yeah, I saw Asia and Gaucho, and I think Gaucho is better. I mean, well, mainly because I was surprised, because I would think that Gaucho would actually be the harder one to do, to get that clean sound for like glamour profession and stuff like that. But they did it. I was shocked. I was thinking, oh, that's like the drum machine kind of shit. But they had a live drummer who did it. And I was like, holy shit. When I saw Gaucho, they also played they played Kid Charlemagne, and the guy who did the guitar solo on that, and he started it off just like the guitar solo on the record, and then he just went to another planet, and I was just like, holy shit, like this guy just like owns this song now, basically. But like the sound that he gets like from his guitar, it's like you think about all the different, you know, like the Jay Graydon sound, like all these different sounds, and he gets all of them. And it's like these guys, this like signature sounds for people, where it's like they work to get this sound, and this guy's just doing all of them. I'm just like, I don't even know how you figure that shit out. I mean, obviously it's probably like they go in the weeds and they research it and they like figure it out, but it's like, I mean, obviously I think the equipment's gotten a lot better too, but it blows my mind. But yeah, seeing them live was a life-changing experience. Cause I didn't think, I was like, even Donald singing, I was like, dude, cause I know he doubles everything. And I was like, you got it, man. You still got the pipes and everything. I mean, I don't know how old is he now?
He's 76.
Oh, he still got it. I saw him on the street, dude. I was going to work I saw him walking down the street, Upper East Side. And I was just like, I wanted to say something, but I was like, he just, like, you know, his face, it's like you see his face and you're just like, he doesn't want to be bothered by anybody. I don't want to fuck with him, dude. I didn't want to be one of those moments where you like meet your hero and then he just goes like puts his hand up and like keeps walking, you know.
I saw some, like, it was either on Twitter or Facebook, somebody like saw Donald on the street and stopped him. It was just like some Steely Dan fan. He was like, yeah, I never do this with celebrities, but like Donald Fagen's like my like number one hero. So I just had to. And he said, hey, sir, are you Donald Fagen? And Donald just goes, sometimes. I thought it was just so Donald of him. Sort of, I don't know. It just had a sense of humor. But anyway, Donald's voice. I mean, that's the other thing about trying to do Steely Dan. It's just like, you can play every single part perfectly, but something about his voice just brings out the character of those songs so much that like, it's very hard. Like I'll see a cover band on like YouTube or something, and like they're playing every note of the guitar solo, like, you know, note for note. And they're, you know, the drum beat is just like Purdy played it on the record, but then like the guy starts singing and it's like, ooh, like it just doesn't have the right like chemistry. I don't know. It's really particular.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I mean, the funny thing is like growing up with, Bob Dylan and stuff, it's like you realize there's like people who love, it's like a love hate kind of voice, you know, where it's like, I mean, my parents hated Steely Dan, which is funny. I mean, I feel like maybe that's why I love them in some ways, because they sort of forced their music on me, and I was just like, well, no, there's a lot of reasons why I like it. But I'd say like he's got that voice where it's like, if you really stop and think about it, you go like, this isn't pretty, but then it's like, but he hits the fucking notes, you know. You know, and it's weird. It's like you realize, even like on the Nightfly and stuff like that, there's some like pretty like intricate singing going on there that like, and I mean, especially like the like Walk Between the Raindrops, like all the harmonies he does and shit there, where you're just like, dude can hit his pitches. But it's got this weird nasal, but it's got the cut. It's got the EQ where it just cuts through everything. And so like, you know, when he goes live, like I thought it was like maybe it was really thin, but it's just like he's got like this honk or something and it just goes right through and it just sits on top of everything. So in some ways it's like perfect for the type of music they did, especially of the era they did, because it's like mixing wise, it was like a very, in some ways kind of thin, but in some ways like very cutting. So it sat on top of the mix no matter what. So, I mean, I think that helps a lot. I mean, I realize that's a big issue with like a lot of singing is like, how do you make the voice sound good, but still, you know, like cut and sit on top of the mix. And yeah, he's got a one of a kind voice. I mean, it's sort of like, there's a lot of people don't like it, which is sort of funny. Like you hear people like, oh, I hate that voice. And I'm just like, dude, yeah, you can't account for taste,
It's a
but
licorice kind of thing. It's like either you love it or
right.
you don't. Yeah. It's
Yeah.
also his phrasing and just like the way he.
Oh yeah. He's
There's a
got
lot of
that
glamour
wine.
profession. Gaucho, he really was leaning into the wine. Like if you really
Oh
just
yeah.
focus on like what, like
Yeah.
the. It's like it gets real nasal on that song and like some of the other ones.
Yeah.
But I
I mean,
think your singing also has some of the. It's not a wine, but there's something about the laid back approach
right.
with those lyrics. It's humorous. Like I feel like there's something funny about the way you were singing, like on
Yeah.
"It's been
I
a
mean,
busy day today, bicep curls on the sand, he lifts a fifth of Tanqueray." Like the way you were singing it in such a mellow tone, it was just,
yeah,
I don't
that was actually, I mean,
know.
I feel like I can't really sit, I can't, I don't have like a real singing voice. I mean, I didn't, I've never been a good singer. So it's like, it's almost like, I feel like singing, it's like adjacent to talking for me, where it's like my talking voice and singing voice aren't very different. It's very soft. So it's like, it's not good for like, I can't, like, I'm sure if I sang live, it would be problematic because I have to sing very soft because it's basically just my talking voice. But I do think that that is sort of conscious though, because it's like if you're going to be a little sarcastic, like you can't be very invested, you know, in the way where like a full-throated singing, it feels a little bit more, I don't know, emotional. Like you have to be a little emotionally detached. I feel like in some ways that sort of just naturally was my voice, so it worked out well in that context. But
It also just it's unique. Like Fagan, it's different because he's like you really feel him trying to do something, you know, like he's
right.
telling a story from the character. Like in the song Gaucho, he almost gets into like you can feel almost anger in the delivery.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well,
So
he's got the, I feel like he's actually kind of a soul singer in a way,
totally.
just sort of like a Jewish soul singer, I guess. But like that's, I feel like that's the vibe. Like I can't, man, I'd love it if I could pull something like that off. I just don't know if I have the, I don't think I have the singing chops to do that. But also, I mean, Busy Day was also it. I originally wrote it as a sort of like a samba, just like a. Almost, I would almost say I wrote it as like a bossa nova kind of, so it sort of had that sort of Jobim style of like laid back singing. And so then when it became more up tempo, it actually I kept that and I was like, this is great because it's like a perfect, you know, it's like you have like a sort of a driving underbelly and then you just have like the super laid back lyrics. And I was like, I love this. But that's actually, I mean, that's a lot of the Japanese stuff that I love is kind of like that too, where it's like very, because I mean, it's funny, like a lot of the Japanese singers like are not good singers, traditionally speaking. And so you can tell that they've really worked at figuring out how to use their voice as best they can. And it's, I think it's similar to me where it's like, it's not full-throated singer. It's like sort of like laid back singing because that's like the only way they can get the pitches. Yeah. Some say he has the perfect.
Could it be he went astray looking for a way?
there's people who write really good lyrics that like have emotions in them that I love, that I'm like that are genuine, that I'm like, that I do love. I mean, like, I think like Leonard Cohen is like one of the great lyric writers of all time. And it's like, but it's something where, and even he has sarcastic moments, but he knows when to use them and when not to. And I mean, he's on another level, but it's like, I'm not going to be in that realm. So I have to accept my limitations on this. And like, I think in some ways, like Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, they collaborated on lyrics. And I think when you collaborate on lyrics, you end up with a much more interesting sort of, yeah, you can go to more surreal places. Like I don't know, my mind is not very necessarily good at sort of like detaching from reality. I feel like I'm that's why, like, yeah. And I think growing up with a lot of sort of like the country, more countryer side of rock and roll and things like that, where there was a lot of lyrics that just told stories, I think that always really captured my imagination. It's like the thing that would, is another aspect that would draw me into a song. But I don't know. I mean, who knows? I mean, there is like a lot of boogie from the early 80s that I do love, where the lyrics are just total pap, but the grooves are just so damn good. And I think, you know, a really good groove is just, you know, it's unimpeachable. It's just like one of those things. It's like, if you nail the groove, man, you've got a song. So it's like, there is some aspect to that where it's like the lyrics can be, you know,
secondary or something.
Yeah, that definitely becomes secondary. But this is the pleasure of, I think, the Japanese side of it is that you don't know what they're saying. So that makes it, in some ways, it makes it way more listenable for me. I mean, I also think the Japanese approach is a lot more maximal, sort of like in a Steely Dan way, where they don't believe in just a groove. They believe in choruses and bridges and all these things. And even in some ways, like intros and outros and all these. So like, there's a lot of different parts. And I think that's something I'm also like,
yeah,
you know, like I love a tune that's like, it's like a jewel. Like there's all these different parts to it. And like,
me too.
I think of like every Steely Dan tune that I loved, it's like, there's always something to it. I mean, even in the super minimal ones, there's always like spice that's added. That's like perfect. It's like the most, to me, it's like the, actually, like people say, I mean, it's the most tasteful, like the arrangements are just like the most tasteful arrangements you can possibly get, like a crystal ball, like a crystal, like where it's like super perfect. So I think in that sense, like working on music by yourself is really awesome, because you can just erase things and redo things until you feel like you sort of have a little crystal of like where everything's in its right place, which is, you know, a luxury of the modern era where we have the technology where you can sit in your bedroom for years, just, you know, messing around.